whatever the hell that meant, and Jat and Socked were going out in another direction with the adorably non-threatening Labradoodle. Katrina would stay in camp, as she refused to hunt on moral grounds. She was, she told Colin, a vegetarian.
"I think it's right criminal," Katrina said of hog hunting, "although those pigs are sort of horrible. But there wouldn't even be any wild hogs except we pen up so many pigs to eat."
"I've been thinking about going vegetarian," Hassan told her, his arm draped around her waist.
"Well, just don't get skinny," Katrina answered, and then they kissed right in front of Colin, who still couldn't get his head around any of this.
"All right, boys,"
Mr. Lyford said, smacking Colin on the back rather too hard.
"Ready for your first hunt?"
Colin nodded with some reluctance, waved goodbye to Lindsay and the others, and headed out with Hassan, whose orange vest was not quite big enough to fit comfortably around his chest. They set off down the hill, not following a trail, just bushwhacking.
"We begin by looking for rootings," Mr. Lyford explained, "places where a hog has been turning up the soil with his long snout."
He talked to them like they were 9 years old, and Colin was wondering if Mr. Lyford thought they were younger than they actually were when Mr. Lyford turned back to them with a can of chewing tobacco and offered them each a pinch. Colin and Hassan both politely declined. Over the next hour, they hardly spoke, because
"the feral hog may shy away from the human voice," Mr. Lyford said,
as if the feral hog did not shy away from other voices, such as those of Martians. Instead, they walked slowly through the woods, their eyes scanning the ground in search of rootings, their guns pointed down into the dirt, with one hand on the stock and the other sweating against the barrel. And then, finally, Hassan saw something.
Mr. Lyford," Hassan whispered.
He pointed to a patch of dirt that had been dug out haphazardly. Mr. Lyford knelt down and inspected it closely. He sniffed at the air. He dug his fingers into the dirt.
"This," Mr. Lyford whispered, "is a rooting. And you, Hassan, have found a fresh one. Yes, a hog has been here recently. Now we track it."
Mr. Lyford doubled the pace then, and Hassan struggled to keep up. Mr. Lyford found another rooting, and then another, and he felt sure he had the trail, so he took off in a kind of race walk, his arms pumping so that the gun wiggled in the air like he was in color guard. After about 5 minutes of that, Hassan hustled up to Colin and said,
"Please, God, no more run walking."
And Colin said,
"Seriously?"
And then they both together said,
"Mr. Lyford?"
He turned around and walked several paces back to the boys.
"What is it, boys? We're on the trail here. We've got a hog almost in sight. I can feel it."
"Can we slow down?" Hassan asked. "Or take a break? Or take a break and then slow down?"
Mr. Lyford sighed.
"Boys, if you are not serious about hunting the feral pig, then I can just leave you here. We're on the trail of a hog," he whispered urgently. "This is no time for lollygagging or dilly-dallying."
"Well," suggested Colin, "maybe you should just leave us behind then. We can sort of protect your flank in case the feral pig doubles back around."
Mr. Lyford looked extremely disappointed. He pursed his lips and shook his head sadly, as if he pitied the poor souls who were unwilling to push their bodies to the limit in search of the feral pig.
"Very well, boys. I'll come back and get you. And when I do, it'll be to get your help carrying out a gorgeous hog."
He started to walk off, and then stopped and pulled out his can of chewing tobacco.
"Here,"
he whispered, handing it to Colin.
"I fear the hog will smell the wintergreen."
Thanks, said Colin, and Mr. Lyford ran off into the distance, weaving through the forest in search of more, fresher rootings.
"Well,"
Hassan said, squatting down to sit on a rotting fallen tree,
"that was fun. Jesus, I didn't think hunting involved so much walking. We should have gotten the sweet gig Lindsay has, sitting in a tree and making out and waiting for a pig to walk by."
"Yeah," said Colin absentmindedly.
"Hey, did you bring the mini recorder?"
asked Hassan.
Yeah, why?
Gimme, he said.
Colin pulled it out of his pocket and handed it over. Hassan pressed record and then started up with his best Star Trek voice. Captain's log, stardate 9326.5. Hog hunting is incredibly boring. I think I'll take a nap and trust in my brilliant Vulcan companion to let me know if any extremely dangerous feral hogs walk by. Hassan handed back the mini-recorder and scooted over to lie down beside the fallen tree. Colin watched Hassan close his eyes.
Now this, Hassan said, is huntin'.
Colin sat there for a while, listening to the wind tease the trees as clouds moved in above them, and he let his mind wander. It went to a predictable place, and he missed her. She was at camp still, and they didn't let her use a cell phone, at least not last year, but just to be sure, he pulled his phone out of his camouflage pants pocket. He got reception, amazingly, but had no missed calls. He thought of calling, but decided against it. He would call when he completed the theorem, which led him back to it, and the seemingly intractable 3 anomaly. 18 out of 19 Catherines worked, but this utterly insignificant blip on the Catherine Adar came out looking like a jacked-up smiley face every time. He remembered her again, thought back to whether he'd failed to account for some facet of her personality in his calculations. Admittedly, he'd only known her for 12 days, but the whole idea of the theorem was that you didn't have to know someone intimately in order for it to work. Catherine the Third. Catherine the Third. Who would have thought that she, among the least important to him, would prove the theorem's downfall? Colin spent the next 90 minutes thinking, without ceasing, about a girl he'd known for less than 2 weeks. But eventually, even he grew tired. To pass the time, he anagrammed her sprawling name, Catherine Mutzensberger. He'd never anagrammed her before, and he was fascinated to find the word 18 within her. Me returns 18 barks. 18 airs makes burnt. His favorite? Remark 18, snub rest. But that didn't really make sense, because Colin had certainly remarked all 19. Hassan sniffled, and his eyes shot open, and he looked around.
Fug, are we still hunting? Big Daddy needs some lunch.
Hassan stood up, reached into the cargo pockets of his pants, and pulled out 2 badly smushed sandwiches in Ziploc bags.
Sorry, dude, I fell asleep on lunch.
Colin opened the canteen hooked to his belt buckle, and they sat down for turkey sandwiches and water.
How long did I sleep?
Almost 2 hours, Colin said between bites.
What the fuck'd you do?
I should have brought a book. I just tried to finish the theorem.
The only problem left is Catherine the Third.
Who that?
Hassan asked, his mouth full of a 2 mayonnaise sandwich. Summer after 4th grade, from Chicago. But she was homeschooled. Catherine Mutzensberger, 1 brother. Lived in Lincoln Square on Levitt, just south of Lawrence. But I never visited her there because she dumped me on the 3rd-to-last day of Smart Kid Camp in Michigan. She had dirty blonde hair that was a little curly, and she bit her nails, and her favorite song was Stuck With You by Huey Lewis and the News, and her mother was a curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art, and when she grew up, she wanted to be a veterinarian.
How long did you know her?
Asked Hassan. His sandwich was finished, and he wiped the remnants of it on his pants.
12 days.
Huh. You know what's funny? I knew that girl.
What?
Yeah, Mutzensberger. We went to all these lame-o homeschooling events together, like bring your homeschooled kid to the park so she learns how to be less nerdy, and take your homeschooled kid for a homeschool picnic so the Muslim kid can get his ass kicked by all the evangelical Christians.
Wait, you know her?
Well, I mean, we don't keep in touch or anything, but yeah, I could pick her out of a lineup.
Well, was she quite introverted and a little dorky, and she'd had a boyfriend when she was 7 who dumped her?
Yep, said Hassan. Well, I don't know about the boyfriend. She had a brother. He was a first-rate nutcase, actually. He was into spelling bees, went to nationals, I think.
Weird.
Well, the formula doesn't work for her. Maybe you're forgetting something. There can't be that many goddamn Mutzensbergers in Chicago. Why don't you call her and ask?
And the answer to that question, because it literally has never occurred to me, was so outrageously dumb that Colin just picked up the phone without another word and dialed 773-555-1212.
What city?
Chicago, he said.
What listing?
Mutzensberger. Mutzensberger.
Hold.
The computer voice recited the number, and Colin pressed 1 to be connected immediately free of charge, and on the third ring, a girl picked up.
Hello?
She said. Hi. This is Colin Singleton. Is Catherine there?
Speaking. What did you say your name was?
Colin Singleton.
That's so familiar,
she said.
Do I know you?
When you were in fourth grade, I may have been your boyfriend for about 2 weeks at a summer program for gifted children.
Colin Singleton! Oh, yeah! Wow! Of all people!
This is going to sound weird, but on a scale of 1 to 5, how popular were you in fourth grade?
What?
She asked. And also, do you have a brother who was into spelling bees?
Yeah, I do. Who is this?
She asked, suddenly sounding upset. This is Colin Singleton, I swear. I know it sounds weird.
I had a few friends. We were kinda nerdy, I guess.
Okay. Thanks, Catherine.
Are you, like, writing a book?
No, I'm writing a mathematical formula that predicts which of two people will end a romantic relationship and when, he said. She answered.
Where are you, anyway? Whatever happened to you?
What happened, indeed, he answered, and hung up.
Well, Hassan said, boy, she must think you're stark raving bonkers.
But Colin was lost in thought. If Catherine III was who she claimed to be and whom he remembered her to be, then what if? What if the formula was right? He called her again. Catherine Mutzensberger, he said.
Yes?
It's Colin Singleton again.
Oh, hi.
This is the last question I'll ever ask you that sounds completely crazy, but did I by any chance break up with you?
Uh-huh.
I did?
Yeah. We were at a campfire sing-along, and you came over to me in front of all my friends and said you'd never done this before, but you had to break up with me because you just didn't think it was going to work long term. That's what you said, long term. God, I was devastated, too. I thought you hung the moon.
I'm really sorry. I'm sorry I broke up with you, Colin said. She laughed.
Well, we were 10. I've dealt with it.
Yeah, but still, I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings.
Well, thank you, Colin Singleton.
No problem.
Is there anything else?
She asked. I think that's it.
Okay, well, you take care of yourself,
she said, the way you might say it to a schizophrenic homeless person to whom you've just given a dollar. You too, Catherine Mutzensberger. Hassan stared at Colin unblinkingly.
Well, dress me up in a tutu, put me on a unicycle, and call me Caroline the Dancing Bear. You're a fucking dumper!
Colin leaned back against the rotten tree, his back arching over it until he was staring at the cloudy sky. Betrayed by his vaunted memory! He had, indeed, remarked 18 and snubbed the rest. How could he remember everything about her and not remember that he dumped her? And for that matter, what kind of asshole was he to have dumped a perfectly nice girl like Catherine Mutzensberger? I feel like I've only ever been 2 things, he said softly. I'm a child prodigy, and I'm dumped by Catherine's. But now I'm neither, Hassan said, and be grateful. You're a dumper, and I'm making out with a ridiculously hot girl. The whole world is turned upside down. I love it. It's like we're in a snow globe and God decided he wanted to see a blizzard, so he shook us all the fuck up. Just as almost no true sentence beginning with I could be spoken by Lindsay, Colin was watching all the things he'd thought were true about himself, all his I sentences, fall away. Suddenly, there was not just 1 missing piece, but thousands of them. Colin had to figure out what had gone wrong inside his brain and fix it. He returned to the central question, how could he have completely forgotten dumping her? Or almost completely, because Colin had experienced a dim flash of recognition when Catherine told him the story of his dumping her in front of her friends, a feeling vaguely like when a word is on the tip of your tongue and then someone says it. Above him, the interweaving branches seemed to split the sky into a million little pieces. He felt like he had vertigo. The one facility he'd always trusted, memory, was a fraud. And he might have gone on thinking about it for hours, or at least until Mr. Lyford returned, except at that very moment, he heard a weird grunting noise and simultaneously felt Hassan's hand tap his knee.
"Dude," said Hassan softly. "Khanzir,"
which is Arabic for pig. Colin shot up. Perhaps 50 yards in front of them, a brown-gray creature was pushing his long snout into the ground and snorting like he had a sinus infection. It looked like a cross between a vampire pig and a black bear, an absolutely massive animal with thick, matted fur and teeth that extended below its mouth.
"Mada al-Khanzir la yatakalamun Arabi?"
Colin asked, which is Arabic for, what, pigs don't speak Arabic?
"That's no pig," answered Hassan in English. "That's a goddamn monster."
The pig stopped its rooting and looked up at them.
"I mean, Wilbur is a fugging pig. Babe is a fugging pig. That thing was birthed from the loins of Iblis."
Arabic for Satan. It was clear now the pig could see them. Colin could see the black in its eyes.
"Stop cursing! The feral hog shows a remarkable understanding of human speech, especially profane speech," he mumbled, quoting from the book. "That's a bunch of bullshit," Hassan said, and then the pig took two lumbering steps toward them. And Hassan said, "Okay, or not. Fine, no cursing. Listen, Satan pig, we're cool. We don't want to shoot you. The guns are for show, dude."
"Stand up, so he knows we're bigger than he is," Colin said.
"Did you read that in the book?" Hassan asked as he stood.
"No, I read it in a book about grizzly bears."
"We're gonna get gored to death by a feral fugging hog, and your best strategy is to pretend it's a grizzly bear?"
Together, they stepped carefully backward, kicking their legs high to get over the fallen tree, which now offered their best protection against the hog. But Satan Pig didn't seem to think much of their strategy, because right then, it took off running at them. For a squat-legged beast that couldn't have weighed less than 400 pounds, the thing could run.
"Shoot it," Colin said quite calmly. "I don't know how," Hassan pointed out.
"Fug," said Colin. He leveled the gun, planted it tight against his exceedingly sore shoulder, turned off the safety, and took aim at the running pig. It was perhaps 50 feet away. He inhaled deeply and then slowly exhaled. And then he pointed the gun up and to the right because he just couldn't bring himself to shoot at the pig. Calmly, he squeezed the trigger just as Lindsay had taught him. The kick of the gun against his well-bruised shoulder hurt so badly that tears welled up in his eyes. And in the shock of the pain, he couldn't tell what had happened at first. But amazingly, the pig stopped dead in its tracks, turned 90 degrees, and ran.
"You sure shot the living hell out of that gray thing," Hassan said.
"What gray thing?" asked Colin. Hassan pointed, and Colin followed the trajectory of his finger to an oak tree about 15 feet away. Crooked between the trunk and a branch, a sort of gray paper cyclone contained a circular hole about an inch in diameter.
"What is that?" asked Hassan.
"Something's coming out of it," Colin said. It doesn't take long for a thought to get from your brain to your vocal cords and out of your mouth, but it does take a moment. And in that moment, between when Colin thought, "Hornets," and when he would have said, "Hornets," he felt a searing sting on the side of his neck.
"Oh, fug!" shouted Colin. And then Hassan said, "Hand!"
They took off running like a couple of spastic marathoners. Colin kicked his legs to the side with each step, like a heel-clicking leprechaun, trying to discourage the bloodthirsty hornets from attacking his legs. Simultaneously, he swatted around his face, which, as it happened, only indicated to the hornets that besides stinging his head and neck, they could also sting his hands. Waving his hands above his head crazily, Hassan ran considerably faster and with more agility than Colin had ever thought possible, weaving around trees and hurtling bushes in a vain attempt to discourage the hornets. They ran downhill because that was easiest, but the hornets kept their pace, and Colin could hear their buzzing. For minutes, as they ran in random directions, the buzzing continued. Colin always following behind Hassan, because the only thing worse than getting stung to death in South Central Tennessee when your parents don't even know you're on a hog hunt is dying alone.
Kafir, I'm fading. They're still on me. Go, 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 go,
Colin answered. But just after that, the buzzing stopped. Having chased them for the better part of 10 minutes, the hornets began the winding journey back to their decimated nest. Hassan fell face first into a brambly bush and then slowly rolled over onto the forest floor. Colin bent over, hands on knees, sucking air. Hassan was hyperventilating.
Real fat kid asthma attack, he finally said.
Colin pushed aside his fatigue and rushed up to his best friend.
No. No, tell me you're not allergic to bees. Oh, shit!
Colin pulled out his cell phone. He had reception, but what could he tell the 911 operator? I'm somewhere in the woods, my friend's trachea is closing. I don't even have a knife to perform an emergency tracheotomy because stupid Mr. Lyford ran off with it into the woods to chase the same goddamn pig that started the whole fucking mess. He desperately wished Lindsay were there. She could deal with this. She'd have her first aid kit. But before he could even register the consequences of such thoughts, Hassan said,
I'm not allergic to bees, Sitz Pinkler. I'm just out of breath.
Oh, thank God. You don't believe in God.
Thank luck and DNA, Colin corrected himself quickly. And only then, with Hassan not dying, did Colin begin to feel the stings. There were 8 in all, each of them like a little fire burning just inside his skin. 4 on his neck, 3 on his hands, 1 on his left earlobe.
How many do you have? He asked Hassan.
Hassan sat up and looked himself over. His hands were cut up from landing in the briar bush. He touched his stings, each in turn.
3,
said Hassan.
3? I really took one for the team by staying behind you, he noted. Don't give me that martyr shit, said Hassan. You shot the bee's nest.
Hornet's nest, Colin corrected. They were hornets, not bees. That's the kind of stuff you learn in college, you know.
Dingleberries, also not interesting.
But there is an important difference. And that important difference was manifested in Colin's throbbing pain. Bees sting people only once and then die. Hornets, on the other hand, can sting repeatedly. Also, hornets, at least the way Colin figured it, are meaner. Bees just want to make honey. Hornets want to kill you. Hassan paused for a moment, then started talking.
God, these stings hurt! You know what I hate? The outdoors. I mean, generally. I don't like outside. I'm an inside person. I am all about refrigeration and indoor plumbing and Judge Judy.
Colin laughed as he reached into his left pocket. He pulled out Mr. Lyford's can of chewing tobacco. He pinched a bit of tobacco and pressed it against his own earlobe. It felt instantly, if only marginally, better.
It works, Colin said, surprised. Remember May Goody told us about it when we interviewed her?
Hassan said,
Really?
And Colin nodded, and then Hassan took the can of dip. Soon, their stings were covered with blobs of wet tobacco, dripping brown, wintergreen-flavored juice.
Now, see, that's interesting, Hassan said. You should focus less on who was Prime Minister of Canada in 1936 and focus more on shit that makes my life better.
William Lyon Mackenzie King, who had enough names for 2 people or 4 Madonnas but was only 1 man, was Prime Minister of Canada in 1936. Their idea was to walk downhill. They knew the camp was uphill, but Colin hadn't been paying attention to which way they ran. And while the cloudy sky made it bearable to walk around in long sleeves and an orange vest, he couldn't navigate by the sun. So they walked downhill because, A, it was easier, and B, they knew the gravel road was down there somewhere, and since it was longer than the camp, they figured they had a better chance of finding it. And maybe they did have a better chance of finding the road than the lodge, but they never found it either. Instead, they walked through a forest that seemed endless, and their progress was slow as they had to step through kudzu and over trees and hop the occasional dribbling creek. "If we just keep walking in one direction," Colin said, "we'll find civilization." Meanwhile, Hassan was singing a song entitled, "We're on a trail of tears, there's dip on my chin and we're gonna die here." Just after 6 p.m., tired and hornet-bitten and sweaty and generally in a poor mood, Colin spotted a house a short walk to their left. "I know that house," Colin said. "What, we interviewed someone there?" "No, it's one of the houses you can see when you walk to the grave of the Archduke," Colin stated with great confidence. Colin gathered his last bit of energy and jogged up to the house. The place itself was windowless, weather-beaten, and abandoned, but from the front of the house, Colin could, yes, see the graveyard in the distance. In fact, there seemed to be some movement down there. Hassan came up behind him and whistled.
"Wallahi, kafir," which is Arabic for "I swear to God," "you're lucky we're unlost, because I was about 10 minutes away from killing and eating you."
They hustled down an easy slope and then fast-walked toward the store, ready to bypass the cemetery. But then Colin caught sight of movement in the graveyard again, turned his head, and stopped dead. Hassan seemed to notice it at precisely the same moment.
"Colin," said Hassan.
"Yeah," Colin answered calmly.
"Tell me if I'm mistaken, but isn't that my girlfriend in the graveyard?"
"You are not mistaken."
"And she's straddling some guy."
"That's correct," said Colin. Hassan pursed his lips and nodded.
"And I just want to make sure we have our facts straight here. She's naked."
"She certainly is." Chapter 16. She was facing away from them, her back arched, her butt bobbing in and out of visibility. Colin had never seen actual people having actual sex before. From his angle, it looked a little ridiculous, but he suspected it might appear different if he were in the guy's position. Hassan laughed silently, and he seemed so amused by the situation that Colin felt okay laughing too.
"This is some fucking snow globe of a day," Hassan said, and then he raced forward about 10 paces, cupped his hands over his mouth, and screamed, "I am breaking up with you!"
Still, though, a goofy grin was on his face. Hassan takes so little seriously, Colin thought. As Katrina turned back toward them, her face shocked and scared, her arms crossed over her chest, Hassan turned away. Hassan looked back at Colin, who finally tore his gaze away from the inarguably quite fetching naked girl before him.
"Give her some privacy," Hassan said,
and then he laughed again. This time, Colin didn't join in.
"You gotta see the humor in it, baby. I'm bug-bit, hornet-stung, bramble-cut, covered in chaw and wearing camouflage. A feral hog, some hornets, and a prodigy led me through the woods so that I might stumble upon the first girl I ever kissed riding talk like he's a thoroughbred next to the grave of an Austro-Hungarian archduke. That," Hassan said to Colin emphatically, "is funny."
"Wait.
Talk?"
Colin's head swiveled back to the archduke's obelisk, where he saw, holy shit, Talk his very self slithering into some camo pants.
The rat bastard!
For reasons that he didn't understand, Colin felt a pulsing rage, and he took off toward the graveyard. He didn't stop running until he got to the knee-high stone wall and was staring Tok dead in the eye. And then he didn't quite know what to do.
"Is my dad with you?" Tok asked coolly.
Colin shook his head and Tok sighed.
"Thank God," he said. "He'd have my ass in a sling. Have a seat."
Colin stepped over the wall and sat down. Katrina was leaning against the obelisk, dressed now, her hands shaking slightly as she smoked a cigarette. Tok started talking.
You're not gonna say a word, because this ain't none of your business. Now, your little Arab friend can have his words with Kat, and that's fine, and they'll keep it between themselves, but I don't reckon you want Lindsay to know anything.
Colin stared at the Archduke's obelisk. He was tired and thirsty and sort of needed to pee.
I think I have to tell her, he said, a trace of the philosophical in his tone. She's my friend, and if I were in her position, I'd expect her to tell me. It's just basic golden rule stuff, really.
Tok stood up and walked over to Colin. He was a sizable presence.
Let me tell you both.
And only then did Colin realize Hassan was standing behind him.
Why you aren't gonna say a word? If you do, I will beat your asses so bad you'll be the only guys in hell walking with a limp.
Hassan mumbled, Sajil, which is Arabic for record. Colin quietly reached into his cargo pocket and fiddled with the device for a moment, then kept his hand in his pocket so it wouldn't look suspicious.
I just want to know, Hassan said to Katrina. How long has this been going on?
Katrina put her cigarette out against the Archduke's obelisk, stood up, and walked over to stand next to Tok.
A long time, she said. I mean, we dated when we were sophomores, and we've been hooking up occasionally ever since. But we came out here, and I was going to end it, honestly. And I'm sorry, because I really do like you, and I haven't really liked anyone since him,
she said, glancing up at Tok.
And I wouldn't have even done it this time, except, I don't know, it was like a goodbye or something. But I'm really sorry.
Hassan nodded.
We can still be friends, he said.
And it was the first time Colin had ever heard those words spoken sincerely.
No big whoop, really.
Hassan looked at Tok then.
I mean, Hassan said, it's not like we had agreed not to see other people.
Tok shot back.
Look, she just said it's over, okay? So that's it. It's over. I'm not cheating.
Well, Colin pointed out, you were cheating 5 minutes ago. That's a pretty narrow definition of cheating.
Shut up before I knock your goddamn teeth in, Tok said angrily.
Colin glanced down at his muddy shoes.
Now listen, Tok continued. They're all coming back here from Bradford in a little while. So we're all just gonna sit here like a big happy family, and when they show up, you're gonna make your retarded jokes and hunch over and look like the shit-sucking pussy you are, and the same goes for you, Hass.
This is what Colin thought in the long silence that followed. Would he want to know? If he were dating Catherine the 19th, and if she'd cheated on him, and if Lindsay knew, and if Lindsay would get physically injured as a result of sharing the information, then, no, he would not want to know. So perhaps the golden rule indicated that he should stay mum. And the golden rule was really Colin's only rule. It was because of the golden rule, actually, that he hated himself for Catherine the 3rd. He'd believed that Catherine's did unto him as he would never have done unto them. But there was more to consider than the golden rule. There was the small matter of liking Lindsay. That shouldn't factor into an ethical decision, of course, but it did. He hadn't quite made up his mind when Lindsay, trailed by Sockt and Jat, came running up with a six-pack of natural light beer in each hand.
When'd you get here? She asked Tok.
Oh, just a minute ago. Kat picked me up as I was walking, and then we ran into them, Tok said,
his head gesturing toward Colin and Hassan, who were seated together on the stone wall.
There was some concern that you might be dead, Lindsay said to Hassan matter-of-factly.
Believe me, Hassan answered, you weren't the only one concerned.
Lindsay leaned in toward Colin then, and he thought for a second she might kiss him on the cheek, and then she said,
Is that Dip?
He touched his ear.
It is, he acknowledged.
Lindsay laughed.
It ain't supposed to go in your ear, Colin.
Hornet sting, Colin said morosely.
He felt so horrible for her, cheery and smiling and holding beer she'd brought for her boyfriend. He just wanted to take her to her cave and tell her there, so she wouldn't have to go through it all in the light.
Hey, By the way, did anyone kill a feral hog?
Hassan asked.
Nope.
Well, not unless you did, Sokht said.
And then he laughed.
Me and Chase shot us a squirrel, though. Blew the damn thing to bits. Princess treed it for us.
We didn't shoot it, Jat corrected. I shot it. Well, whatever. I saw it first.
They're like an old married couple, explained Lindsay. Except instead of being in love with each other, they're both in love with Colin. Tok laughed heartily, while the other two boys repeatedly asserted their heterosexuality. For a while, they drank. Even Colin stomached down the better part of a beer. Only Hassan abstained.
I'm back on the wagon, he said.
By then, the sun was sinking fast toward the horizon, and the mosquitoes had come out. Colin, already sweaty and bloody, seemed to be their favorite target. Lindsay was cuddled up against Tok, her head nestled between his peck and shoulder, his arm around her waist. Hassan sat next to Katrina, chatting with her in whispers, but they did not touch. Colin was still thinking.
You're not so talkative today, Lindsay said to Colin eventually. Sting's getting to you?
They burn like the fire of 10,000 suns, Colin said, deadpan. Pussy, Tok said, showing the grace and eloquence for which he was widely famous.
And maybe it was for the right reasons, and maybe it wasn't.
But right then, Colin pulled the mini recorder out of his pocket and rewound it. To Lindsay, he said, I'm really, really sorry. And then he hit play.
Dated when we were sophomores, and we've been hooking up occasionally ever since. But we came out here, and I was going to end it.
Lindsay bolted upright, staring at Katrina with a gathering malice. Tok, strangely, was frozen. He'd never expected Colin Singleton, noted Sitzpinkler, to say a word. Colin hit fast forward, then play again.
She just said it's over, okay? So that's it. It's over. I'm not cheating.
Lindsay raised her beer, chugging it, and then crumpled the can and dropped it. She stood up and stepped toward Tok, who was still leaning in a state of apparent calm against the obelisk.
Baby, he said, you don't understand. I said I wasn't cheating, and I'm not.
Screw you, she said,
and then she turned around and walked away. Tok caught her in his arms from behind, and she wrestled to get free of him.
Get off me right now!
She shouted, but he held on tight, and then she sounded panicked, screaming,
Get off! Get him off me!
Let her go, Colin said softly.
And then, behind him, he heard Jat.
Yeah, Colin, get off her!
Colin turned around and saw Jat march up to Tok and grab him by the collar.
Calm the hell down, Jat said,
and then Tok threw Lindsay to the ground. Tok hit Jat in the face with a right cross, and Jat fell to the ground like a dead man. As Jat lay there, unmoving, Colin wondered at the fact that Jat had gone after Tok. Colin had underestimated him. Tok quickly turned around and grabbed Lindsay by the ankle.
Let her go, Colin said, standing now. You pardon, Lul,
which is Dutch for horse's penis. She was kicking against his grip, but he was persistent, holding her tighter, saying,
Baby, stop, you don't understand.
Hassan looked at Colin. Together they ran toward Tok, Hassan aiming for a body slam in the midsection, and Colin going for a crazed punch to the head. At the last moment, Tok reached one hand out and hit Colin in the jaw so hard that the hornet stings didn't sting anymore. And then with his leg, Tok swept Hassan's feet out from under him. They weren't much for damsel in distress saving, Colin and Hassan. But then again, Lindsay wasn't much for being a damsel in distress. After Colin hit the ground, he opened his eyes and saw Lindsay reach up, grab Tok's nuts, squeeze, and turn. Tok fell to his knees, hunched over, and released Lindsay. His head scrambled. Colin crawled to the Archduke's obelisk, the only geographical location in the world that wasn't currently spinning. He grabbed hold of the obelisk with both hands and clung to it. Opening his eyes, he saw Jat still face down. Lindsay and Katrina were kneeling over him. And then Colin felt angels lifting him by the armpits, pulling him toward their home in the sky, and he felt light and free. He turned to his left and saw Hassan. He turned to his right and saw Sokht.
Hey, said Sokht, you all right?
Yeah, Colin said.
That was nice of your friend to, get hit like that.
He's a good guy. This is effed up, man. We've been dealing with this Colin and Kat crap for 2 years. I love Colin, but this is ridiculous. Lindsay's good people.
Talk interrupted. He seemed to have recovered.
Stop talking to that little bitch.
Oh, come on, Col. You screwed this one up, bro, not him.
You're all such goddamn pussies, Talk shouted.
And then Hassan said, it's 3-on-1, and charged Talk. And sure, it was 3-on-1, but what a one. Hassan's run was met by a body punch that entered cartoonishly far into his gut. Hassan started to fall, but couldn't, because Talk had his hand wrapped around Haas's neck. Colin rushed in then with an overhand right. The punch connected, but one, Colin forgot to close his fist, so he was slapping, not hitting. And two, instead of slapping Talk, he ended up slapping Hassan flush across the cheek. Whereupon, Hassan finally succeeded in falling down. Sokht jumped on Talk's back then, and for a brief moment, it seemed the fight might be a draw. Then Talk grabbed Sokht by one arm and threw him halfway across the graveyard, leaving Colin and Talk standing more or less toe-to-toe. Colin began by employing a strategy he'd just invented called the windmill, which involved windmilling his arms around to keep his attacker at bay. The strategy worked brilliantly for about 8 seconds, until Talk caught hold of his arms, and then Talk's square, reddened face was inches from Colin's.
I didn't want to do it, dude, explained Talk with a remarkable calm. But, you know, you made me.
Technically, Colin mumbled, I kept my promise. I didn't say any...
But his thoughtful explanation was cut off by a fast-coming kick. In the moment before the strike, Colin felt it in his loins, phantom pain, and then Talk's knee came up into Colin's groin so hard that Colin briefly left the ground. Flying, he thought, on the wings of a knee. And then, before he'd even fallen, Colin vomited.
This is the end of disc number 5. Please continue listening on disc number 6. This is disc number 6.
In the moment before the strike, Colin felt it in his loins, phantom pain, and then Talk's knee came up into Colin's groin so hard that Colin briefly left the ground. Flying, he thought, on the wings of a knee. And then, before he'd even fallen, Colin vomited. Which turned out to be a fairly good idea, since Talk ceased to pursue him. Colin fell to the ground, moaning, waves of pain radiating from his middle. It felt as if the Franz Ferdinandian hole in his gut had now torn, and the pain grew and grew from a bullet hole to a canyon, until finally Colin himself was the hole. He'd become a racking, all-over vacuum of pain.
Oh, God, Colin said finally. Oh, God, my balls.
Colin misspoke. In a better state, he would have recognized that it wasn't his balls that hurt, but rather his brain. Nerve impulses flew from his testes to his brain, where the brain's pain receptors were triggered, and the brain told Colin to feel pain in his balls, which Colin did because the body always listens to the brain. Nuts, arms, stomach, they never hurt. All hurt is brain hurt. The pain made him dizzy and faint as he lay on his side, crouched in the fetal position, his eyes closed. His head swam with the nauseating ache, and for a moment he fell asleep. But he had to get up, because he could hear Hassan grunting as he received blow after blow. So Colin crawled to the obelisk and slowly dragged himself up, his hands walking up the Archduke's grave.
I'm still here, Colin said feebly, his eyes shut as he held onto the obelisk for balance. Come and get me.
But when he opened his eyes, Talk was gone. Colin could hear the cicadas out in force, humming to a rhythm that matched his still throbbing balls. Through the gray twilight,
Colin saw Lindsay Lee Wells and her red-crossed first aid kit tending to a seated Hassan, whose camouflage shirt and orange vest were covered with blood. Socked and Jat were sitting together sharing a cigarette. There was a lump above Jat's eye that looked literally like his forehead was about to birth a chicken egg. Colin got dizzy and then turned back around, hugging the obelisk. When he opened his eyes again, he realized his glasses were gone, and between the dizziness and his astigmatism, the letters before him started dancing. The Archduke Franz Ferdinand. He anagrammed to dull the pain. "Huh," he mumbled after a moment. "That's a hell of a coincidence."
"The Kafir has awoken," Hassan noted.
Lindsay rushed over to Colin, wiped the last flecks of chaw from his earlobe, and whispered into his ear,
"Mein Held,"
German for my hero.
"Thanks for defending my honor. So where'd he get you?"
"In the brain," Colin said,
getting it right this time. Chapter 17. The next morning, a Monday, was their 22nd morning in Gutshot, and indubitably the worst. Aside from the residual tenderness in and around his nuts, Colin's entire body was sore from a day spent walking and running and shooting and getting hit. And his head hurt. Each time he opened his eyes, beams of feverish, demonic pain shot through his brain. The night before, paramedic in training Lindsay Lee Wells had diagnosed him with moderate contusions and sprained balls after an exhaustive search of medical websites. She diagnosed Talk as suffering from "I'm an asshole and Lindsay's never going to speak to me again"-itis. Keeping his eyes closed as much as possible, Colin stumbled toward the bathroom that morning, where he found Hassan staring at himself in the mirror. Hassan's lower lip was hideously busted. He looked like he was chewing a fat wad of tobacco, and his right eye was very nearly swollen shut. "How you doing?" asked Colin. Hassan turned to him and gave Colin the full view of his well-punched face as if to answer the question. "Yeah, sure," Colin said, reaching in to turn on the shower. "But you should see the other guy." Haas managed a wan smile.
"If I could do it all over again," he said, his speech slow and vaguely mangled by his massive lower lip, "I'd just let myself be trampled to death by the Satan pig."
As Colin came down the stairs to breakfast, he saw Lindsay sitting at the oak table sipping a glass of orange juice.
"I really don't want to talk about it," Lindsay said preemptively, "but I do hope your balls are okay."
"Me too," said Colin. He'd checked on them during his shower. They felt the same, only tenderer. Their assignment that day, left in note form by Hollis, was to interview a woman named Mabel Bartrand.
"Oh, man," Lindsay said when Colin read the name to her. "She's at the other home, the one for when you're really old. I can't take that today. I can't. God, let's just skip. Let's all go back to sleep."
"I'm for that," Hassan mumbled through his meaty lips.
"She could probably use the company," Colin said, trying to use his familiarity with loneliness for the powers of good.
"Lord, you do know how to lay on the guilt," Lindsay said. "Let's go."
Mabel Bartrand lived in an assisted living facility about 15 miles outside of Gutshot, one exit south of the Hardys. Lindsay knew the way, so she drove the hearse. On the drive, no one talked. There was too much to discuss. And anyway, Colin's whole body felt like pure, undiluted crap. But his life had finally calmed down enough to return to the troubling question of Catherine III and the failure of his memory. His head, however, hurt too much to make any sense of it. A male nurse met them at reception and guided them to Mabel's room. This place was significantly more depressing than Sunset Acres. Here, the only sound was the whirring of machines, and the halls were mostly empty of people. A TV blaring the weather channel in the common room went unwatched. The doors were mostly closed. The few people seated in the common room looked confused or blank or, worst of all, scared.
"Ms. Mabel," the nurse said sing-songily, condescendingly, "you have some visitors."
Colin turned on the mini recorder. He was using the same tape from the day before, taping over Tok's confession.
"Hello,"
Mabel said. She was seated in a leather recliner in what looked like a dorm room, with one twin bed, one chair, a long-ignored wooden desk, and a mini-fridge. Her thinning, curly white hair was styled into a kind of old-lady Jewfro. She hunched forward, and she smelled old, vaguely like formaldehyde. Lindsay leaned forward, her arms around Ms. Mabel, and kissed her cheek. Colin and Hassan introduced themselves, and Ms. Mabel smiled but didn't speak. Belatedly, Mabel asked,
"Is that Lindsay Wells?"
"Yes'm," said Lindsay, sitting down next to her.
"Oh, Lindsay, darling, I ain't seen you in so long. It's been years, hasn't it? But, Lord, it's good to see you."
"You too, Mabel."
"I've thought about you so much and wished on you visiting, but you never did. Don't you look so good and grown up. No more blue hair for you, uh-uh. How have you been, baby?"
"I've been good, Mabel. How about yourself?"
"I'm 94. How do you think I'm doing?"
Mabel laughed, and so did Colin.
"What's your name?"
she asked Colin, and he told her.
"Hollis," she said to Lindsay. "Is that Dr. Dinzenfar's son-in-law?"
Miss Mabel leaned forward and pointed a finger that would not straighten in Hassan's direction.
"No, Miss Mabel, I'm Hollis's daughter, Lindsay. Dr. Dinzenfar's daughter, Grace, was my grandma, and Corville Wells was my grandpa. This is Hassan, a friend of mine who wants to talk to you about the old days in Gutshot."
"Oh, well, that's fine," Ms. Mabel said. "I get confused sometimes," she explained.
"That's okay," said Lindsay. "It's awful good to see you."
"And you, Lindsay, I can't get over how pretty you look. You right grew into that face, didn't you?"
Lindsay smiled, and now Colin noticed that Lindsay had tears in her eyes.
"Tell us a story about the old days in Gutshot," Lindsay said, and it became clear to Colin that this was not an occasion to be asking Hollis's four questions.
"I've been thinking on Dr. Dinzenfar. Before he started that tactilry, he owned the general store. I was just a little thing, knee-high to a bird dog. And he only got one eye, you know, fought in the First War. Well, one day, we was at the store, and Daddy gave me one red penny, and I ran up to the counter there, and I said, 'Dr. Dinzenfar, do you have any penny candy?' And he looked down at me and he said, 'I'm sorry, Mabel. We don't have any penny candy in Gutshot. All we got is free candy.'"
Mabel closed her eyes as they all let the story sink in a bit. She seemed almost asleep, her breathing slow and rhythmic, but then her eyes snapped open and she said,
"Lindsay, I sure miss seeing you. I missed holding this hand."
And then Lindsay began crying in earnest.
"Miss Mabel, we gotta go, but I'm gonna come back later this week and see you again, I promise. I'm sorry I haven't visited in so long."
"Well, that's fine, sweetie. Don't you go getting upset about it. Next time you come, show up between 12:30 and 1, and I'll give you my Jell-O. Sugar-free, but it ain't bad."
Mabel finally let go of Lindsay's hand, and Lindsay blew a kiss and left. Colin and Hassan lingered behind to say goodbye, and when they got into the common room, they found Lindsay sobbing, death cry of a hyena sobbing. She disappeared into a bathroom, and Colin followed Hassan out the door. Hassan sat down on the curb.
"I can't handle that place," he said. "We're never going back in there."
"What's wrong with it?"
"It's sad, and not in a funny way," Hassan said. "It's not the least bit fucking funny, and it's really getting to me."
"Why does everything have to be funny to you?" asked Colin. "So you don't have to ever really care about anything?"
dingleberries, Dr. Freud. I'm actually just going to issue a blanket dingleberries on all attempts to psychoanalyze me.
Aye, aye, Captain Funny Pants. Lindsay showed up outside then, seeming to be fully recovered.
I'm fine, and I don't need to talk about it, she said, unprompted.
That night, he finished the theorem. It proved relatively easy, actually, because for the first time in several days he had no distractions. Lindsay was locked in her room. Hollis was downstairs, so entranced in her work/TV that she never so much as said a word about Hassan's black eye or the fist-shaped bruise on Colin's jaw. Hassan was off somewhere, too. A lot of people could lose themselves in the Pink Mansion, and that night, a lot of people did. It proved almost unfairly easy to finish it. Now that he knew about his time as a dumper, the formula, as he had it, was very close to accurate. He needed only to tweak a radical to finalize the formula. Everyone came out looking correct, which is to say that Catherine Mutzensberger looked like a long, narrow U that was centered on the Y-axis and crossed the X-axis twice. A perfect graph for a fourth-grade love story. Upon putting down his pencil, he held up his hands, fists clenched tight, like a marathoner winning a race. Like the hare coming from behind and screwing up the story by beating the tortoise. He went looking for Lindsay and Hassan and eventually found them in the game room.
I finished our theorem, he told Lindsay, who was seated on the pink felt of the pool table, her brown eyes still puffy.
Hassan was ensconced in the green leather couch.
Really? Asked Lindsay.
Yeah, it took like 8 seconds. I actually almost finished it like 2 weeks ago. I just didn't realize it worked.
Kafir, said Hassan. That is such good news that I almost want to get off the couch and shake your hand. But God, it's comfortable. So, now can you use it for, like, anything? Like, for any two people?
Yeah, I think so.
Are you going to use it to predict the future?
Sure, offered Colin. Who are you looking to date?
Uh-uh, dude, I tried it your way with the dating and the girls and the kissing and the drama, and man, I don't like it. Plus, my best friend is a walking cautionary tale of what happens to you when romantic relationships don't involve marriage. Like you always say, Kafir, everything ends in breakup, divorce, or death. I want to narrow my misery options to divorce or death, that's all. That said, you could do it for me and Lindsay Lohan. I wouldn't mind converting her to Islam if you catch my drift.
Colin laughed, but otherwise ignored the diatribe.
Do me and Colin, Lindsay said softly,
her eyes staring down at her bare tan knees.
The other Colin, I mean, she added.
And so Colin did. He sat down and balanced a book on his knees, then pulled out his notebook and pencil. As he filled in the variables, he said,
Now, just so you know, getting cheated on counts as getting dumped. I don't want you to get pissed off about it, that's just the way the theorem works.
Fair, Lindsay said curtly. Colin had played with the theorem so much that he knew from the numbers what it would look like, but he still went through the motions of plotting each point. When he showed it to her, she said,
Wait, what's that?
That's talk dumping you, answered Colin.
So it works, she said, her voice empty of emotion. It's weird. I feel sad, but not about him. All I feel about breaking up is I'm just relieved.
Relief is a dumper emotion, Colin noted with some concern. Lindsay hopped off the pool table and plopped down on the couch beside Colin.
I think I just realized that I don't actually want to date an asshole I'm not even attracted to. Those are two separate revelations. I don't want to date assholes, and I'm not actually turned on by big muscles. Although I did cry like a 2-year-old in the nursing home, so the relief is possibly temporary.
Hassan grabbed the notebook from Colin.
It really fugging seems to work.
Yeah, I know.
Well, although, not to poop on your party, but you proved what I already knew. The guys who play football know how to play the motherfugging field, and that Catherine's dump Collins like Hassan's eat monster thick burgers, voraciously, passionately, and often.
Well, the real test is whether it can predict the arc of a relationship, Colin acknowledged.
Oh, hey, Lindsay said, seeming to remember something. Ask Hassan what he was doing in the game room about 20 minutes before you showed up.
What were you doing in the game room about 20 minutes?
God, don't take her so literally, Hassan said. I was on the internet.
Why were you on the internet? Hassan stood up, smiling through his busted lip. He rubbed the Jufro as he walked by, and then paused.